We generally describe our constitutional convention as a great triumph, followed by the even greater triumph of ratification. It was sent out to all the original 13 states, and one by one, after intense debates, they approved it. Well, if you're a regular listener, you already know that one state, Rhode Island, didn't ratify for a long time after the rest of the states did. But did you know that there was another holdout? Did you know that that state actually said no? In fact, it's the only state that refused to ratify the Constitution of the United States. Have I whetted your curiosity? Well, here to satisfy it is a fellow by the name of Thomas Howard. He works at the Center for the Constitution at Montpelier, and he's written a paper on the ratification in the state of, oh, I'm not going to spoil it for you. You'll have to listen. Stay tuned.
Your weekly Constitutional is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Professor of Constitutional Law, Stuart Harris.
One of the great things about working with Montpelier and mostly with the folks at the Center for the Constitution is that they're so interesting and they do such interesting things. Well, there's one young whippersnapper there, a fellow by the name of Thomas Howard, who just joined this last year. He is a very recent graduate of the University of Virginia and a very accomplished one, I might add. He was the president of everything, or at least he was president of a very prestigious society called the Jefferson Debating Society. And he's been very, very academically inclined. In fact, I don't think I'm giving anything away when I say that I believe Thomas is going to go on to bigger and better academic things. And maybe one day he'll be a law professor just like his mentor and idol. That would be me. Ha ha, Thomas. At any rate, Thomas and I have lots and lots of great conversations. And the last time I was out at the center, quite recently, actually, Thomas said, you know, I've done an entire paper on the ratification or the non-ratification, rather, of the Constitution of the United States in the state of, well, I'll let Thomas tell you.
So my name is Thomas Howard. I am the content development manager for the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution, which is housed at James Madison's Montpelier. In that capacity, I'm responsible for working with a number of scholars to build content for online courses and also for our on-site residential seminars.
Content manager. What does a content manager do? I mean, other than managing content, or what exactly would managing content mean?
Well, I spent a lot of time with a lot of text, taking material on ideas about the American Constitution, American government, American history, and playing around with them, coming up with different ways for us to teach the public about these constitutional ideas. It's a lot of fun. I get to learn a lot while I'm doing the work that I've been asked to do.
Indeed. You and I are going to be working together very closely in the near future, aren't we? Because we're going to be developing a whole new course together, aren't we?
Yes.
It's going to be on law enforcement, right?
Absolutely.
In fact, I think I have a meeting up there with you and Jen Howell tomorrow, and we're going to be talking about developing that. And that's one of the wonderful things that we do there. Of course, I think probably the premier experience at Montpelier is actually to go there and actually to, you know, physically be there and experience the Constitutional Village and all the rest of it. But a close second is the wonderful internet-based courses. You've got the online courses. And I've done one of them before on the Bill of Rights, before you got there, because you're a young whippersnapper. Now you're going to be helping with the law enforcement one, right?
Absolutely. And it's unfortunate there are only so many people that we can bring out to the site at one given time. So this is a great way for us to reach out and drive our content to more people. And we love working with the law enforcement community because it's a great way to find direct application for constitutional ideas. These are people that have to reckon with the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, every day in their professional capacities. So there's a great opportunity for impact for us. And you would be amazed at how much coffee the cops drink when they're on site.
That's absolutely true. In fact, because I was there for a recent law enforcement seminar and had a great time doing it. It was really great fun. Love cops. I love law enforcement people. And they were very, very engaged and very knowledgeable. And they did drink a lot of coffee. But then again, so did I. So it's probably mostly my fault. Okay, well, I did reference your youth here, and that is relevant to what we're talking about, because you just graduated from the University of Virginia, which is last year?
I graduated 2 years ago with a bachelor's in history and then a master's degree in higher education administration.
Okay. And so recently you did some work on a thesis.
I did.
And that thesis is going to be the subject of our discussion today.
It will. And that thesis was on ratification of the U.S. Constitution in North Carolina.
Wait a minute. We're in Virginia. Why Virginia? Come on. Why not Virginia?
We are in Virginia. But North Carolina is a subject that has been neglected by historians of ratification. I had a wonderful pen pal, the best pen pal that a student of history could ask for, Pauline Meyer. Mm-hmm. Who unfortunately passed away last year.
Yeah. And I was about to interview her. Do you know that? She literally was on my list to interview with a couple of other historians. Gordon Wood was also somebody I interviewed as well. And she passed away. It was terrible. It was really. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to go off on that. It was sort of a sad thing. But you actually had her as an advisor?
I met Pauline Meyer when I was a student in the We the People program in high school. Mm-hmm. And stayed in touch over the years. And she had just written a book, Survey History of Ratification, that if anyone's looking for a great entree into that subject, her book is bar none the best.
Really?
And we started talking about it, and she said, well, you know, if there's any one area that is not researched enough, that we don't know enough about, it's North Carolina. The last time that anyone had written a dedicated piece of work about ratification in North Carolina was 1932. By a historian by the name of Louise Irby Trenholm.
Wow.
Fascinating little book, but dusty, to say the least, right. By now. And I thought it was a great opportunity to pull out a fascinating case of history and try to delve a little bit more, update the scholarship on it, and take the opportunity to teach people about what happened there.
Well, that does sound fascinating. Before we get into it, I have to ask you, did you talk to Woody Holton or Gordon Wood? Those were the other two guys, the two guys that I interviewed in the episode I was going to interview Pauline in. Did you talk to either of them about this?
You know, I didn't.
Okay.
It was one of those things that once the idea was out there, I had to run with it.
Well, of course you did. Of course you did. Well, but there's also something other than the fact that North Carolina maybe has gotten neglected by historians. It also has a pretty interesting distinction, doesn't it? Just in terms of the order of ratification and all that.
Absolutely. So North Carolina was the only state to reject the Constitution, which puts it outside of the Union in 1789, when the federal government is constructed and finally pulled together after enough states have ratified to put the government in action.
Right. Article 7 required at least 9 states to ratify, right? And so as of when did the 9th, I guess that was the following summer, wasn't it? New Hampshire was the 9th state, right?
New Hampshire was the 9th state before Virginia.
Right. And then Virginia and New York came on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you had 11. I mean, you had New Hampshire made it 9, and then Virginia and New York came in. And they were, population wise and influence wise, extremely important, even though they weren't technically necessary. So you're up to 11. But then Rhode Island didn't ratify for a long time until years later. But then, so there were two, that leaves two, doesn't it? Yeah.
North Carolina and Rhode Island, absolutely, the two
okay.
holdouts.
Those were the two holdouts, but you said that North Carolina was the only one to actually reject it.
Yes.
Okay, so let's pick up the story there. How did we, I mean, they actually voted it down?
Absolutely. So I think this, the whole concept of ratification is fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to take 55 of our best and brightest, brilliant men and put them in a room together, but we're not going to tell anybody else what's going on. Mm-hmm. They're going to deliberate in secret. And they're going to spend 3 months over the summer of 1787 making decisions, changing the decisions they've made, and finally drafting a constitution that they will submit to the candid world. First, mm-hmm. it goes to Congress. Congress says okay and submits it directly to the states.
Mm-hmm.
And then the states each on their own terms get to say yes or no and ultimately ratify the Constitution. And I think what's...
And North Carolina was in. Rhode Island was a holdout. It just simply took extra time. But North Carolina was the only one that said no.
Said no.
Okay, they should put that in their license plates. The no
You know,
state.
They have a little celebration every year.
Of the no vote?
In Hillsborough, where the convention took place for the no vote. But I think what's often lost today is that we have a sense of inevitability about the Constitution. Surely it was, it was going to be ratified. It was going to end up the way it is today. But that's absolutely not the case. we talked about the great fights in Virginia and New York. Imagine if one of those states had said no, and both of them came quite close,
right,
to saying no. So I think there's a couple points, things to understand about North Carolina before we really launch into the fight for ratification there. So three things. First, North Carolina is a state with a huge population,
mm-hmm.
but a very low density. So the first census in 1790, there are almost 300,000 whites, almost 5,000 free blacks, and about 100,000 slaves. That's good for the fifth largest white population in the country and good for the third largest total population in the country.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, there are no major cities. So imagine a North Carolina without Raleigh, mm-hmm. without Durham, without Greensboro, without Chapel Hill. And it's worth noting that the Hillsborough Convention, that's the ratifying convention, actually drafts the charter for Raleigh to create a capital city for North Carolina. They do a couple other things aside from treat the Constitution while they've got all these citizens together.
I mean, considering ratification of the brand new U.S. Constitution was not enough for them, so they're doing side deals?
They did a couple other things. They also considered the charter for the University of North Carolina.
Their problem. They were distracted. They were appointing dog catchers as well. I don't know. Okay. So they're in Hillsborough, and just for the geographically challenged, where's Hillsborough?
So Hillsborough is about in the center of North Carolina. It's about 20 miles away from Chapel Hill, if I recall correctly.
Okay.
So no big cities and no capital city. We often refer to New Bern as the colonial capital of North Carolina. That's not really all that accurate. The capital was wherever the governor was from, and the assembly would move around. And there's a couple pretty funny moments. There's one incident where they were carting the official papers of state around, and some papers blew off the top of the wagon and into the river. And the guy, the attendant there, said, it's too cold. I won't go after them. So this causes a bunch of issues for North Carolina. The second is lack of hard currency. There's almost no specie gold or silver in the state. And so they do a couple things. 1715.
Before we get to that, let's talk about money for a second. Mm-hmm. This is long before there was a national currency.
Absolutely.
And so when we're talking about hard money, we're talking about obviously gold and silver are the best, the hardest, gold being the very hardest of the hard currencies, despite being a soft metal. And they might come from other nations. They might come from Britain, obviously, or they might come from Spain or elsewhere. And if they weren't of those metals, then they were in the form of banknotes, which were issued by individual banks, which probably would only have been accepted if the bank was known to the people in question. And if you don't have a lot of big cities, you probably don't have a lot of big banks issuing a lot of notes. So I guess it starts to be more understandable why there wouldn't be a lot of money in circulation. So it was mostly a barter economy.
It was mostly a barter economy. And the thing that I would add on banks being trusted or known, they also had to be trusted. So North Carolina in 1715 designates a bunch of commodities as currency. And this is common in many states, tobacco, rice, often designated as currency, but usually states would stop there. North Carolina designates 16 commodities as currency, and a couple of years later, they up it to 22. But then you get all of these different things. Tobacco, the value fluctuates quite a bit over the years.
So a crate of tobacco is worth 6 chickens this year, but 4 chickens next year.
Right, but even more dramatic than that.
Wow.
Or 6 chickens one year and like half a chicken the next.
Okay. That's messy.
And so this is messy and unreliable. And so we switch to banknotes and paper currency. And it's issued by the state of North Carolina, or the colony of North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And this too proves to be unreliable because nobody trusts the good word of North Carolina outside of the state itself.
Right.
And even inside, people are a little uneasy. And so it becomes the case that it's decreasing in value quite quickly. So quickly, in fact, that the government decides it would be a good idea to control that and depreciate the currency by law. And so by 1782, the value of one North Carolina dollar is set by law at 800 to 1 based on the Spanish milled, your basic gold coin dollar.
Mm-hmm.
And so this money is completely worthless.
So it takes 800 North Carolina dollars to buy one Spanish dollar or coin.
If whoever's buying is interested.
Right. I mean, that's the legal exchange rate. So you're saying the actual exchange rate on the black market would have been much higher. I mean, it would cost you even much more.
Yeah, it would have been much worse.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm having a perfectly fascinating conversation with a young fellow named Thomas Howard, who works for the Center for the Constitution at Montpelier. And it turns out that while Thomas was at the University of Virginia, he wrote a thesis all about the non-ratification of the Constitution by, yep, now you know, the state of North Carolina. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Thomas Howard. Stay tuned. Well, Doug, today you're not wearing a Union Jack, but you're handing me something, and you're handing me a little apple.
It is an apple.
It's a very nice-looking little apple. It's red and green.
Apples, I have to give you an apple because peaches are not in season, but we are talking about impeachment.
Okay, that's got to be one of the most convoluted things you've ever done at the beginning of a
peach
quiz.
But we didn't have peaches, so I got you. It was either that or
it's
next.
About a peach-sized fruit.
It was either that or grapes.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Good. And good. Well, very tasty. Okay.
There goes my lunch.
All right.
Great. Okay.
Well, do we have anybody on the line?
Hello?
Yeah, that would be you, Tammy.
Yes, Tammy.
Yes, that's right, Tammy. That's right. That's what's coming up on my screen here. Well, Tammy, where are you from?
West Virginia.
West Virginia. What part of West Virginia?
Eastern Panhandle, top of the Shenandoah Valley.
The eastern, that's actually quite near Washington, D.C. then.
Yes, actually. A lot of people commute from there to D.C.
Is that near Harper's Ferry?
Yes, I'm about 25 minutes from Harper's Ferry.
Beautiful, beautiful area, absolutely. Well, Doug, do you have a tough question for Tammy today?
I do have. I've got a great question. It's a question about the Constitution, and it deals with impeachment.
All right.
Mm-hmm. So I'm in Article 3, Section 2, Clause 3. The trial of all crimes, except in cases of impeachment, shall be by jury. Tammy, why can't trials in the case of impeachment be jury trials? Is it A?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Is it A? Impeachment is only tried in the full Senate. B? The House of Representatives serves as the jury in an impeachment trial. C? The Supreme Court serves as the jury in an impeachment trial. Or D? Because it would be impossible to represent the entire country with just 12 angry jurors.
Well, that's a little convoluted because I know that, I agree with D.
Yeah, D does make sense, doesn't it? It would be hard to find 12 angry representative jurors. Okay.
Well, I think it'd be easy to find 12 angry people, but, you know.
Actually, quite easy.
I know that it starts in the Congress. So, by law, it starts in the Congress. So,
right.
Whatever is that B?
Let me give you those choices again. A, impeachment is only tried in the full Senate. B, the House of Representatives serves as the jury in an impeachment trial. Or D, the Supreme Court serves as the jury.
Okay. So that's why impeachment doesn't have a jury, for one of those three reasons.
Yes.
Okay.
If I remember from the last one, it initiated in the House of Representatives and then goes to the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know which one is considered the jury, I'll be honest.
Let's talk this through. It originates where? In the House?
I know that originally, for the Bill Clinton impeachment, they voted for it in the House.
Right.
And then it went to the Senate, and it failed in the Senate. And it seems to me, if I remember correctly, that...
Let's think it through. Now, both of them are involved. You're right. The House is where the articles of impeachment come from.
Mm-hmm.
And
so I guess the Senate would serve as the jury. I guess that's how it would be viewed. I've never...
Okay. Is that your answer then? Answer choice A?
Yes.
You're sure now?
No. No, because I never thought of one as the jury and the other.
You know, this is exactly right. You have nailed it on the head, but unknowingly.
Unknowingly.
Yeah.
Unknowingly.
Impeachment starts in the House.
Right.
But the actual trial for impeachment happens in the Senate.
So she got it right.
She did.
And the answer is A.
And in the case of the president, who's the head of the impeachment trial in the Senate?
Who would that be,
Tammy?
Be
the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
Chief
Excellent.
Justice of the Supreme
Bonus.
Court, not the vice president, who would normally preside as the president of the Senate.
And there's a pretty good reason for that, isn't there?
There sure is.
A bit of
is.
A conflict of interest if the
bit.
Vice president's about, to judge the president. I understand that. Okay. Well, very well done, Tammy,
great
and
job.
You thought it through. I thought you were going to get a little bit confused there with the House and the Senate, but you thought it through and you got the right answer. So well done.
Yay.
Well, Tammy,
didn't totally embarrass myself. Yay.
No, you did a fantastic job. Well, give us an email at ywc@montpelier.org and send us your address and send us your T-shirt size, and we'll send you your T-shirt and a pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier.
Well, thank you. I have a pocket constitution in every purse that I own, so I'll have another one. Yay!
Well, now you'll have another, and it makes a great stocking stuffer in case you've got enough of your own.
Well, no, it just means I have to buy another purse, doesn't it?
Oh, glad to help you out with that one, Tammy. Okay, and thank you, Doug.
Thank you, Stuart. It's the Constitution.
Thank you.
I read for the articles.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional and my conversation with Thomas Howard of the Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier, all about the ratification, or I should say the non-ratification, of the U.S. Constitution by the state of North Carolina. As we were discussing before the break, North Carolina's politics had a lot to do with money. Or rather, the lack of money, for you see, North Carolina's money wasn't worth much of anything.
Most things are running on lines of credit. And as the revolution approaches, North Carolinians start to experience what it feels like to have that called back in. Their British merchant partners are saying, oh, we want you to pay up, we want you to pay up. They're scrambling to find things that will actually be accepted.
That must have caused huge problems. There was a huge credit crunch in the early 1770s, and as you said, in the lead up to the revolution, there was actually a big financial bubble and a big scandal. I think it started over in Scotland, but at any rate, a lot of those British merchants were calling in these lines of credit that were being used by the planters to send their tobacco over to European markets. And golly, you know, when you think of the practicalities. When you don't actually have specie money, when you don't actually have a standard mode of exchange, how in the world did people even conduct trade back then? I mean, it must have been so remarkably inefficient. But anyway, I'm just commenting on that. Go on, please. You got a story to tell.
And so, North Carolinians never want to be put in that situation again, where mm-hmm. they're financially dependent or at least subservient to another authority, something outside of their particular local situation that understands how their commerce needs to sort of be helped along mm-hmm. because there's no money. So that's something that we'll come back to, okay. And a major issue that they'll have with the Constitution is its effect on money. The last thing about North Carolina in the 1770s, 1780s. Is the long-standing political divide in the state, and that's between conservatives in the East and radicals in the West. And eastern part of the state, Albemarle Sound region, town of Edenton, is where you have most of your lawyers, that sort of thing, and your large plantation slave owners.
Right.
In the backcountry, you have small, poor farmers that are feeling very neglected by the eastern interests that really do control most of the affairs of the state. So right.
A lot of that's dictated by topography, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got the relatively low flat land near the coast, which is good for plantations and lends itself to slave labor. And then you've got the mountainous regions in the western part of North Carolina, which to this day are poorer and I'm sure feel neglected by the people over in Raleigh. So isn't it interesting how geography and topography sort of dictates these things? But please go on.
And that plays right into one of the major sticking points, which is how do you tax land? Do you tax it the same when land is more productive in the east because it's more fertile? Well, they did tax it the same across North Carolina, and that becomes a major point of contention as Westerners start appealing to the state government to say, look, this is overbearing. We can't afford to pay the same level of tax on our land as the more productive parts of the state can. And they're underrepresented. By county, they would add another county in the west, and at the same time, they would slice one of the existing counties in the east up into two to inflate the representation in the east and to keep it depressed in the west. So by 1771, a delegate to the General Assembly in North Carolina from the east was representing about 1,700 people, and one from the west was representing about 7,300 people.
Wow. So
it's difficult to overstate how imbalanced this was and how much of how much difficulty this caused.
You know, this is really fascinating, Thomas, because, you know, today, right now, we're arguing about voting and we're arguing about voting rights, and people are lamenting the gerrymandering that happens all over the country and, you know, how it favors this party or it favors that party. And of course, people have gotten much, much better about gerrymandering these days with all the computers and the ability to analyze voting patterns and all that. But this was an issue right from the very beginning. I mean, and voting is one of the great unaddressed issues in the Constitution. And so it's interesting to hear that on a state level was such a huge issue. But please go on.
And it was even unaddressed in the state charters and early state constitutions. That's what allowed this kind of political maneuvering of balancing out representation. But as I said, it really did cause quite an issue. We hear a lot about things like Shays' Rebellion. Well, there's one in North Carolina, too. Mm-hmm. It happens in 1771. It's called the Regulator Rebellion.
So this is a bit earlier than Shays was in the late 1780s. Okay, so this is earlier.
A little bit earlier, but violent rebellion, intensely violent rebellion about these issues of representation and taxation and the sort of removed control that exists in the state that was very much centered in the East. Mm-hmm. So this is right before the Revolution. And right after the Declaration of Independence, a couple days later, Continental Congress directs all states to write their own constitutions, new for the newly created states. And the radicals from the West gain some control in this process. They secure a vote not by county, but by delegate in the drafting of this new constitution. So it does a couple things that are common trends in state constitutions. It creates a strong legislature and a weak governor. But most importantly, it solidifies local control. So you have justices of the peace in each county, and they're given immense responsibility. They're going to decide where the postal roads go. They're going to decide where all of the government contracts go. They're going to decide how to draw lines of personal plots of property, things like that. And they're also going to have a great amount of judicial power. They're going to start deciding cases about debts and contracts, things that because of the money shortage are huge issues in North Carolina. So there's a great consolidation of power, or shall I say diffusion of power, to these local authorities. And it's usually one or two people who are appointed as justices of the peace in a county that become real great local leaders.
It sounds like the traditional good old boy system was actually ensconced in their state constitution.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Absolutely. Well, that's very interesting. So that's setting the stage for when we actually have our national constitutional debate, because that's the way the government is in North Carolina when it comes time to ratify or not ratify the Constitution.
Absolutely. So by the time we get to the 1780s, the division between the Eastern interests, the conservative interests, and the radical interests, all of these kind of local authorities, becomes so bitter that James Hogg, who is a prominent Federalist, writes to James Iredell calling the radicals a set of unprincipled men who sacrifice everything to their popularity and private views. They seem to have acquired too much influence in all of our assemblies. So this is kind of the scene into which the Constitution gets thrown. We know people are drafting it in Philadelphia, but we really don't know what it's going to look like. And so 1787 in September, we finally get a look, and we know that we're going to have to make a decision. So what do? You circle your team, you huddle, you get all your folks together, you assess your chances, and you come up with a strategy. And so here are where some really fascinating figures start to emerge. First and foremost amongst them is James Iredell. Iredell's not a delegate to Philadelphia, but his importance really can't be understated. He becomes the ringleader of the Federalists, and he'll ultimately get appointed to the first Supreme Court. And he's sometimes called
U.S. Supreme Court?
The U.S. Supreme Court.
Oh, okay,
yes.
Okay. Wow. Okay.
The first U.S. Supreme Court. He's often called the Constitution's ablest defender. If James Madison is the father of the Constitution, then James Iredell wants to defend the Constitution, particularly in North Carolina. William Richardson Davey, one of the founders of the University of North Carolina, is another prominent Federalist. Archibald McLean is kind of this ornery, crotchety, takes no nonsense from anyone Federalist. And then Governor Samuel Johnson, the incoming governor, is also in favor of the Constitution. On the other side, Wiley Jones. What a great name.
Wiley Jones. I'm guessing he's a radical.
He's a radical.
He's a wily radical.
He's a wily radical. He likes to play and pick at personalities. And he is the greatest proponent of this paper currency.
Mm-hmm.
And then folks like Timothy Bloodworth and Judge Samuel Spencer, who is the most vicious ad hominem attacker that the anti-federalists have. He has no problem going after people who he perceives as elite or privileged or ensconced in kind of an old order.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said something there that I just want to pause on. You said that Wiley or one of the other fellows was in favor of this paper money. And I'm going to guess here, and you tell me if I'm wrong, it's basically that the radicals, the people who felt they were poorer and neglected, liked the paper money because they were able to pay their debts in it.
Absolutely.
And they were able to pay for their mortgages, et cetera. But it was their creditors, who were probably from the conservative elites over in the East, who wanted hard money. They wanted their debts paid in hard money. So this was the old hard money versus paper money, silver. This is a recurring issue throughout much of American history, hard money or easy money. And okay, so that was part of the radical platform then.
Absolutely.
Okay,
you've hit
good.
Right on the
okay, good.
Right on the issue there.
All right.
And so the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists are busy kind of circling their wagons. Hugh Williamson, who was a delegate in Philadelphia and
from North
and
Carolina.
A Federalist from North Carolina, wants to get up ahead of the curve. And so he urges the entire state, be very careful who you elect to the General Assembly this year, because this issue of the Constitution is going to come up. We're going to have to decide to call a ratifying convention first, and then what will happen. These elections get very chaotic. William Hopper, who had been a signer of the Declaration of Independence, gets in a fight, gets a black eye. over who's allowed to cast a ballot in one of the local elections
mm-hmm.
for the General Assembly that year. And Williamson, when he gets back, starts giving speeches in favor of the Constitution, the new Constitution. He says that the system of government which has been proposed by the late convention is well calculated to relieve us of many of the grievances under which we've been laboring. It is more free and more perfect than any form of government that has ever been adopted by any nation. And then he goes on to say, hitherto you have delegated certain powers to the Congress and other powers to the Assembly of the States. The portion that you have delegated to Congress is found to have been useless because it is too small. And the powers that are committed to the assemblies of the several states are also found to be absolutely ineffectual for national purposes because they can never be so managed as to operate in concert.
Mm-hmm. That was the Articles of Confederation.
So he's hit on a very important point, which is the changing balance between state sovereignty under the Articles of Confederation and consolidating more sovereignty into the national government,
right,
under the Constitution. And that will sort of provide the central theme for many of the objections that North Carolinians will level against the Constitution.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking about the state that said no. No, that is, to the ratification of the United States Constitution. I'm not speaking about Rhode Island. Rather, I'm speaking with Thomas Howard of the Center for the Constitution at Montpelier, who's talking about North Carolina. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll return and finish our discussion with Thomas Howard. Stick around.
In my mind, I'm gone to Carolina. Can't you see the sunshine? Can't you just feel the moonshine? Ain't it just like a friend of mine to hit me from behind? Yes, I'm gone to Carolina in my mind.
In the year 1785, James Madison wrote indignantly to James Monroe, "The policy of Great Britain, to say nothing of other nations, has shut against us the channels without which our trade with her must be a losing one, and she has consequently the triumph, as we have the chagrin, of seeing accomplished her prophetic threats, that our independence should forfeit commercial advantages, for which it would not recompense us with any new channels of trade. What is to be done? Must we remain passive victims to foreign politics, or shall we exert the lawful means which our independence has put into our hands of extorting redress? The very question would be an affront to every citizen who loves his country. What then are these means? Retaliating regulations of trade only. How are these to be effectuated? Only by harmony in the measures of the states. How is this harmony to be obtained? Only by an acquiescence of all the states in the opinion of a reasonable majority." With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blalock.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And now it's time for us to finish our discussion with Thomas Howard of the Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier, all about the non-ratification of North Carolina. Before the break, Thomas and I were talking about some of the more prominent personalities in the North Carolina ratification debate.
James Iredell also starts writing at this point. George Mason in Virginia has written a series of objections, and Iredell writes responses to them.
Objections to the national constitution.
Exactly.
Right?
Mm-hmm. But the Federalists are up against a wall here. I mentioned before that there are no large cities in North Carolina, and that one of the side effects of that is that there are no newspapers with large circulations. So as the Federalists start to answer some of these objections that are surfacing in the Constitution, they're writing to newspapers. But the circulation is not there for those ideas to spread throughout the state. And
in 1787, just to clarify, this is pre-internet.
It is.
Okay, good.
Pre-text messaging, no Twitter. They tried a hashtag campaign, and it really just didn't catch on.
I mean, nobody had any smartphones. But actually, that's not just a silly observation. I mean, that's basically what you're saying, is that there was very little way to disseminate information here, and it was extremely inefficient. And I'm guessing that the anti-Federalists, which I'm guessing also were mostly for the radicals from the western part, they were able to communicate just as effectively, maybe more so, I'm guessing, than the plantation owners. Is that that a fair statement?
Absolutely. And there's an old adage that it's much easier to scare someone to get them to say no, to get them to be opposed to something than mm-hmm. it is to assure them that everything's going to be okay. So the anti-federalists are able to engage in this kind of scare tactics campaign that the new national government will be overbearing, that it will come in and it will disrupt local economies, that it will take from the people the ability to govern themselves and put it in some far removed central national capital.
Yeah, and just look who's supporting it. It's all those Eastern fancy boys who are supporting it, and I imagine that's an argument against it too.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So the General Assembly decides to finally call a ratifying convention. It's set to meet in Hillsborough on July 21st, 1788. And when the dust settles, the Anti-Federalists have a huge commanding lead. We've been debating this now for several months, and sentiment in North Carolina is decidedly against the Constitution.
Now, they must have gotten a few Eastern delegates, too, because I'm just guessing here, because you were telling me that everything is sort of overwhelmingly stacked in favor of the Easterners in terms of representation on a state level. Wouldn't that also have been the case, at least arguably, at the beginning of a constitutional convention? I mean, didn't the Easterners have some sort of representational advantage at that convention, or didn't they?
They did to a certain extent, but remember, a lot of things have changed with the Constitution of 1776. After the rebellion,
oh, okay,
the
so there wasn't
of power
quite that
has
balance.
Shifted a little bit.
Okay, so there's not that overwhelming electoral representational advantage for the East.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that makes it easier to understand.
Is
okay.
That to stand for election to be a delegate, you didn't actually have to live in the county that was sending you.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of gamesmanship of, well, if we send these people here, they might be able to get elected. I don't know if I can get elected from my county. Let me go somewhere else and run
right
there. It all shakes out that the Anti-Federalists have a really commanding lead. They level, I think, three key arguments against the Constitution. The first is related to this issue of paper money. Mm-hmm. Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution dictates that no state will be allowed to issue its own currency, and all the only currency that will be allowed to be issued is by the national government, and it has to be backed. And this is seen as eliminating the varied advantages for debtors
and their money.
The rural concerns that you mentioned earlier. It's also linked to the issue of taxation. If we're going to let this new national government tax us, well, what are we going to pay the taxes with?
Mm-hmm.
If we no longer have our own currency or gold or silver
right.
In our state with which to pay it. The second is the creation of a federal judiciary.
Really?
As I mentioned, local leaders, justices of the peace, are very comfortable with the amount of power that they can now exercise.
Only they don't want federal judges states. Being appointed in their state.
Exactly.
So it's just a power sharing thing. Okay.
Grabbing authority, grabbing jurisdiction from those local judges, including, again, the ability to decide cases based or that revolve around issues of currency, debt, mm-hmm. and contract. And the classic anti-federalist argument against the Constitution is that it lacks a Bill of Rights.
And it's where George Mason plays into it very well.
Absolutely.
That's his major objection. Okay, so you've got these three basic objections. You've got an overwhelming anti-federalist vote. So I'm guessing that's when they vote it down. When does that happen?
So you get to Hillsborough on July 21st, 1788.
Mm-hmm.
And Wiley Jones, there in the convention as the leader of the anti-federalists, says, I'm so confident in our majority that I don't think we need to debate the Constitution. I think we can just...
they don't even have a debate.
We can just say no.
Just call the question.
And move on. James Iredell says, no, absolutely not. We've gone through all of this, and the people have entrusted us to come and consider and decide on the Constitution. And so finally, he's respected enough that they say, okay, fine, we'll consider it clause by clause. And they start doing that, and the room is silent. And the Constitution starts to be read clause by clause by clause by clause. And some Federalists get up and say, well, you know, aren't you going to object? Aren't you going to argue against the Constitution? And the Anti-Federalists say, no, we don't really feel like it.
Oh, man. You know, I've been at county commission meetings like that. They've already decided how they're going to vote. And so they're just going to wait until the question's called. And they're so confident that they're not even going to debate. Wow. Wow. The Federalists must have, their hearts must have been stopping.
They are, I mean, and they're dismayed.
Right, of course
they're disappointed in the citizens of their state. That
we don't even want to talk to you about it. We're just going to vote you down. Finish up, boy. Finish up reading that Constitution, and we're going to vote you down.
Absolutely.
Oh,
and
boy.
So Wiley Jones says, oh, I don't know. I can offer you a strategy. Maybe you have one of your own people get up and argue against the Constitution so that you can respond to those arguments. And that creates a really interesting dynamic. There's a debate in Hillsborough between Federalists on one side and Federalists on the other side.
Oh, good heavens.
And it becomes one of the most thoroughgoing analyses of the Constitution because they know all of the objections. We've been rehearsing them for months in newspapers, in local elections.
And in other states. Yeah, wow.
Absolutely. And so all of this is being recorded. And to fast forward in the story a little bit, the Constitution gets rejected out of hand by almost 100 votes.
Wow. And out of how many people were there?
It was 84 to 183.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's a slam dunk, all right.
So it was a resounding defeat. But now Iredell and Davey have the record of these debates.
Right.
And if there are no newspapers, there are printing presses. And so they print thousands of copies of these. And they distribute them all over the state.
Oh, no, that was smart. That was really smart because
I think so.
Here's a debate that the Federalists themselves controlled. They threw softballs out there, hit each one of them out of the park, and now they get to print this out and distribute it everywhere.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Tremendous. Yes. All right. Go on, please.
So they do this, but North Carolina is put in a really interesting spot after they say no. As I mentioned, enough states have ratified to put the federal government in action.
Right.
North Carolina is left out of this process. They don't have any congressmen. They don't have any ability to participate in the debates of the first Congress to consider what amendments will actually go into the Bill of Rights.
Right, and they're divided.
So
and the South
considered.
Carolina's to the south. Georgia is down there and Virginia to the north. So it's like this big gap in the country down there.
And so this concerns both North Carolinians and the rest of the country.
Of course.
Rhode Island is one thing. It's small. It's off to the side.
Yeah, take care of those guys later. That's right.
But North Carolina, hugely populous state,
mm-hmm.
and it's a gash in the middle of the country.
Right.
And so Washington starts doing things to try to bring them in.
George Washington,
right. Uh-huh. Who's just been unanimously elected president. He gets Congress to pass a tariff that is the same tariff effectively that a foreign country would have to sit under.
Oh,
North
man.
Carolina is being treated as a foreign country.
Right.
Meanwhile, in Congress, Madison has proposed what will become the Bill of Rights. That starts to allay more concerns on the part of the Anti-Federalists. And Washington is really putting pressure. He sends a great speech down, you know, won't you join us? And the other really interesting episode from this time period that I'd be remiss to leave out is a letter to James Iredell, who everyone has recognized as doing this great defense of the Constitution. And they say, we understand that North Carolina for the moment is outside of the Union, but we really kind of want to put you on the Supreme Court. So hypothetically, if we were to have a seat there for you, would you be willing maybe to move to a state inside the Union so that we can put you on the Supreme Court? This doesn't end up happening. North Carolina ratifies by the time the appointments to the first court sort of process their way through approval by the Senate.
So they have a second convention.
But a great moment of practical politics by these people. They have a second convention in Fayetteville almost a full year later. Wiley Jones decides at this point, it's too much. I'm not even going to show up.
Can't fight George Washington.
The Federalists win a pretty convincing victory and ultimately ratify the Constitution.
So it was James Madison with his Bill of Rights. It was Iredell with his record of the arguments that now everyone's had a chance to read and consider. And finally, it's George Washington basically saying, join us, please, and if you don't, we're going to impose so many tariffs on the imports of your goods that you won't have any trade with the rest of the country.
And good luck on the Western frontier, because we won't protect you.
Pretty compelling arguments. So they made their point the first time round, but ultimately they couldn't be the single major holdout for the Constitution. Fascinating. So they're almost the last state to ratify. They're the no state. Any final thoughts? That's a fascinating story. Any final thoughts before we finish up?
It's often treated as an afterthought in American history. After all, the nation was already going by the time much of this story happens.
Right.
But remember that the Bill of Rights was added to the Constitution not more than a couple of years later. These are major concerns that were leveled against the Constitution, and they were ultimately heard. You also have the 11th Amendment that deals with controlling the jurisdiction of the court.
Mm-hmm.
These are major things that affect the path that our country took and the shape of the Constitution. And so I don't think that saying no and arguing against the Constitution as it was initially proposed can be understated.
And one last question. Did any of this have anything to do with the creation of North Carolina barbecue sauce?
I think the spiciness of the anti-federalists might have
It must have been it. Okay, because we know North Carolina barbecue sauce is pretty darn good stuff. So Thomas Howard, formerly of the University of Virginia, thanks very much for sharing your senior thesis. What was it called? What was the title of your thesis?
It's called The Grand Question of Union.
The Grand Question of Union, and a grand title for it. So I'm betting you got a good grade on it.
It went over all right. It was a little long, though. Cut down.
Thanks so very much for being with us here today.
Thank you very much, Stuart.
North Carolina, friendly mountain breezes, North Carolina, with its sandy beaches, wonderland of variety. Close to mountains, it's great to be right here in North Carolina. Love the pines around in North Carolina. Get your cares behind you, living is right in Holiday Bright, North Carolina.
North Carolina, would you like to roll along scenic highways? Let your travels bring you
face to face with history or new excitement you'll agree.
It's all in North Carolina, bigger land of pleasure, life can be finer.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Thomas Howard of the Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier for that fascinating tale about the non-ratification of the state of North Carolina. You know what? If you get on the internet and you Google your weekly constitutional and you find our podcast, not only can you listen to parts of this episode that you might have missed, you know, when the kids started acting up or when you had to get out of the car, you can do that. And you can also listen to over 150 other archived episodes. And I guarantee there's at least one there that you will love. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Chad Barrett. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our music is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. Our Madison Minute is by Jim Blaylock, who refuses to ratify anything. I'm Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.